So, we start with my dear friend, who we all know, Dr. David Satcher, former Surgeon General and Assistant Secretary for Health. I was thinking about his introduction and some of the things I know about him. I know that he was at Meharry as the president. I know he was at Morehouse as president for a while now, runs the Satcher Institute for public health leadership. I know that he's highly regarded and revered around the world as it relates to the work that we all do. David is just a wonderful friend, a brilliant guy, and I'm just so glad he's on the panel with me. Larry Cohen, another great gentleman from the West Coast, runs the Prevention Institute out of Oakland, California. He's the founder and executive director of the Prevention Institute, a nonprofit national center dedicated to improving community health and equity through effective primary prevention, systematic, comprehensive strategies to build audiences and to prevent illness and injury before they occur. I think I've worked with Larry around the Unity Project, where he has cities all over the United States that are doing projects around preventing youth violence. Mark Lays, JD, executive director of the Mayors Against Illegal Guns, which has been in the news a lot, I'm sure you've heard lately. A bipartisan coalition of more than 1,000 mayors from across the country, co-chaired by New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Boston Mayor Thomas Menino. During his tenure, the coalition has doubled in size, and its member mayors have been joined by 1.5 million grassroots supporters, making it the largest gun violence prevention group in the United States. And last but not least, Gary Slutkin, MD, physician and epidemiologist, former chief of intervention development for the World Health Organization, an innovator in violence prevention, and the founder and executive director of Cure Violence, formerly known as Ceasefire, a scientifically proven public health approach to violence reduction utilizing a three-pronged approach taken directly to the public health model. First, interrupt the transmission. Second, identify and change the thinking of the highest potential transmitters. And third, change social norms. Look forward to a great session. Take a lot of notes, ask a lot of questions. Without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to our first speaker, Dr. David Satcher.
Good morning. Thank you very much for that very kind introduction, President Troutman. I'm delighted to be able to join you and especially to be a part of this very outstanding panel. I was just thinking this morning that my introduction to violence really came a very long time ago. Next week, I'll be going to Birmingham, Alabama, which is only 60 miles from my home, to speak at one of their 50th anniversary celebration of the bombing of 16th Street Baptist Church and the killing of those four little girls. And when I think back on it, violence was sort of a way of life growing up in Alabama. I remember that when we lived out on a farm and when the police would come into the community, we would all run and get under the house because we had been told that the police were not kind to blacks. And so that was the environment. And then when I was a teenager, I remember George Wallace coming to Alabama when he was running for governor. And my brother Charles, who was a little older than I was, went and hid in the bushes because we weren't allowed in that park. And he came back and said, well, George Wallace said that before he would see one black student go to the University of Alabama, he would deputize every white man in Alabama, including those in prison. And he won the election, of course, as you remember, overwhelmingly. So that was the environment. I'm saying that because it was the next year that Martin Luther King Jr. and the people in Montgomery started the bus boycott and walked to work in various other places for a year until the Supreme Court ruled in 1955 that segregation of buses was unconstitutional. But it was a culture of violence. It was an atmosphere of violence. Well, it's a long ways from there to being director of the CDC in the mid-1990s when we funded Arthur Kellerman to do research on guns and violence. It was the first research we had funded of the kind. And Kellerman and his team compared two communities. One community in which guns were not allowed in homes, and the other community, which they were, was really border communities in Seattle area and Canada. But anyway, what he found was striking, as many of you know. He found that the homes in which there were guns, the people in those homes were more likely to suffer from gun violence than people who didn't have guns. And that was not easy to understand then, but when you think about it now, and maybe even before now, what happens with guns, and many of us grew up in homes where there were guns, is that the danger of children finding and playing with those guns and somebody getting shot is pretty high. The danger of somebody getting depressed, and if you get depressed, severely depressed, and you have a gun and you use it, it's much more likely that you're going to die from that attempt than if you were to take pills, for example, and end up in the emergency room where often we were able to get people into treatment. So having a gun expedited suicide, and today almost twice as many people die in this country from suicide as homicide. That's the nature of guns. But also, you may remember that when that study was published, Congress shortly after took all of the money out of the CDC's budget and made it very clear that we were not going to be funded to do research dealing with guns. And it really was until very recently that President Obama has attempted to restore funds at NIH and CDC for research dealing with gun violence. I'm saying all this because I really think that what we need to understand violence is a public health approach. And I think, unfortunately, we have not been able to carry out such an approach over the last, well, almost 20 years now, since that money was taken. Research is really critical in terms of the public health approach. I was supposed to tell you that I don't have a lot to disclose in case that's relevant to. I have served on the boards of Johnson & Johnson and work with the Speaker's Bureau. I come with the perspective at the Satcher Health Leadership Institute at the Morehouse School of Medicine. We're interested in developing leaders, and I think when it comes to this issue, what we need is new leadership. We have some great leadership up here on the panel, but the next generation of leadership, I think, is really critical to deal with this issue. Our focus is on all kinds of disparities in health, and you probably know that between gun violence or violence is the leading cause of death between the ages of 15 and 24 for African Americans and Native Americans in this country. So it's an area of major disparities. Mental health is an area of major disparities, and I released a Surgeon General's report on mental health in 1999. But those are areas of major disparities, and so our focus is to try to develop leaders. We believe that today the need for leaders is too great to leave their emergence to chance alone. That's basically what we believe. Now, when you think about youth violence, you think about the public health approach, the first question you ask is, of course, what is the problem? And as Surgeon General, I released the Surgeon General's report on youth violence in 2000. Some of you might remember that in April, I believe, 1999, we had the Columbine shooting. At that shooting, 14 students died, two of them were the perpetrators, and one teacher. So 15 people died in the Columbine shooting. It was, in a way, at least in my memory, the first major shooting like that, especially at a school in this country. And the American people were up in arms, really, demanded action. So the Surgeon General's report on youth violence was requested of me by the President and the Congress during that time of great concern. We did the report. We released it in late 2000, made some major recommendations about the nature of the problem of youth violence and what we could do. We talked about easy access to guns. We talked about communities in which there was a sense of insecurity of the kind I described in Alabama, but even in predominantly black communities where there was poverty especially, this sense of insecurity and fear of each other was very prominent. In addition, of course, we talked about mental health and the need to really remove the stigma for seeking treatment for mental health and so on. So that was the nature of that when we released our report. And it takes a community to raise a child, and it certainly takes a community to deal with violence. But I also want to remind you of something about the public health approach. In 2014, we will celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Surgeon General's report on smoking and health. That was the first ever Surgeon General's report. Even though the Office of the Surgeon General had been around since 1871, there had never been that kind of communication between the Surgeon General and the American people until Dr. Luther Terry released his report in 1964 on smoking and health. And it was the beginning, not the end, it was the beginning of research in this area. And since Dr. Terry, every Surgeon General has released a report on smoking and health. Why? Because every Surgeon General has had something new to report, because the research has gone forward in this area. When Luther Terry released his report, we did not know about the effects of secondhand smoking. That was to come in 1972. We certainly didn't know, as David Kessel so well put it, that smoking was a pediatric disease, because of the people who are addicted to smoking, 85 to 90% of them became addicted while they were children. All of that we've learned since that first report. My point is that if you don't have ongoing research, the public health approach does not work. It's one thing to answer today what is the problem in terms of demographics and quantity, but it's another thing to continue to look at that problem and analyze it and make new recommendations. We have not been able to do that when it comes to guns and violence, and hopefully we will be in the future. Well, I'll say a word about mental health. It's been an area that I've spent a lot of my time as Surgeon General, and since that time. This report that we released in 1999 made several points about the magnitude of the problem of mental illness, its disabling impact, and made several recommendations about it, the main one being imperative access to mental health services. Now, the research has continued. We've demonstrated that it's cost-effective to provide mental health service, but it was not until 2008 that President Bush signed the legislation giving imperative access to mental health services, but only requiring insurance companies that had mental health services to cover it at the same rate that they covered other things. It was not until later, when President Obama mandated that as a part of the Affordable Care Act, all insurance companies would have to cover mental disorders. It was an essential health services and had to cover it at the same rate as other problems. So it's been but I want you to see how we keep moving forward in dealing with this. We have a long ways to go. Mental health is the kind of problem that requires a lot of work, and we're continuing to do that. But violence is a major problem, especially with mass killings. Almost invariably, there are some mental health issues involved there. There are a lot of lessons we can learn. And let me just state four of those lessons from smoking and health. One is research is critical to go forward. Two, community education is critical. We have to continue pounding the messages so that people really get them. Thirdly, we have to have policies in place and to continue to put new policies in place to keep up with the science, if you will. And we also have to impact social norms. You remember when it was popular to smoke? When a room like this would be filled with smoke, you could hardly see the slides? That's no longer the social norm, but it was. The day will come when it will not be the social norm for people to have easy access to guns or to have difficulty achieving access to mental health services. So, and I have to tell you that one of my former fellows actually put this together. She's sitting on the front seat here, Dr. Kushti from Haldra. So all of these messages that are much more effective than what I can communicate about what freedom of speech means in the context of gun violence, freedom of worship. We virtually worship guns in this country. Freedom from want. If you want to go outside and jog in the morning, especially if you're a woman, it could be very dangerous. But guns have made our communities dangerous. And freedom from fear, because a lot of people are dying. Well, the McKinley model, says that we have to attack this problem at the level of individuals, at the level of communities, and at the level of policy. But the bottom line is that in order to eliminate disparities in health, we believe that we need leaders who first care enough, but we also need leaders who know enough, will do enough, and who will be persistent until the job is done. Thank you.